Welcome to another edition of the Mormon Wellness Project. I'm your host, Wendy Perry, and this is another in our series on race and the priesthood.
Another man standing, Hugh B. Brown. During the 60s, one progressive leader was Hugh B. Brown. Like Nelson Lowry, he was one man standing tall. He was a Canadian with progressive ideals. In 1963, Hugh B. Brown even read a statement in General Conference pledging the church's support for civil rights. This was a big deal at the time, because most of his colleagues in the church hierarchy were wishy-washy in support of civil rights, to be generous. Even the venerable old President David O. McKay, who realized the nature of the pressing problem, still did not support racial integration, affirming instead a separation of the races. He also supported segregation practices at the church-owned Hotel Utah. Originally, the hotel allowed black employees, but no black guests. This policy extended to famous entertainers like Harry Belafonte, Marian Anderson, and Ella Fitzgerald, who were all denied hotel rooms. Anderson was eventually allowed to stay at the hotel, on condition that she not use the elevator and eat her meals in her hotel room. Brown was caught between a colossal wedge and a very hard place, as an outspoken defender of the church, while at the same time working within the ranks to try to get the priesthood ban lifted. In 1963, Hugh B. Brown had told a New York Times reporter that the change was imminent, and it got reported that the top Mormon leaders were considering eliminating the priesthood ban. This was in no case true, but in 1969, Brown claimed once more that the ban was about to be lifted. Why was he out there saying this? What could have been going on behind the scenes? Well, Brown was assuming a lot more than he should have. According to authors Matthew L. Harris and Newell G. Bringhurst, in the book The Mormon Church and Blacks, A Documentary History, he was basing his assumption on the fact that he had secured support from a majority of the Council of 12 Apostles, who concurred that a change was necessary. So here you had Church President David O. McKay, who was ill and not attending any meetings, Harold B. Lee, the senior apostle, and Alvin R. Dyer, both opposed lifting the ban, but they were out of the country on assignments. So Brown attempted his coup. Seizing the opportunity, he convinced a majority of those present to support him. Alas, when Brown and Dyer returned to Salt Lake City, they rejected what Brown had done and got Ann Alden Tanner from the First Presidency to join with them in dismantling the majority who wanted to side with Brown and to withdraw their support from Brown's proposal. Well, of course, the law of unintended consequences was in full force then, just as much as it is today. But anyway, here's what happened. Harold B. Lee decided, alrighty then, I'll show you progressive Mormons a thing or two. And Harold B. Lee wrote up his own official 1969 statement, reaffirming black priesthood denial as doctrine. I'm going to take a bit of a sidebar for a second. In an essay I recently wrote, I stated my opinion that the reason we ended up with a revelation from then-Apostle Nelson, tripling down on the LGBT November policy, was in large part due to pressure from the ex-Mormon and progressive Mormons, who got locked in a dance with Orthodox Mormons over the issue. And in order to clear things up, we got a revelation. Could that have been avoided if the email hadn't been leaked? If the steady drumbeat of, it's only a policy and it can be changed, hadn't pushed Nelson into a corner? Could the local leaders have dealt with the craziness of that policy before it became, quote-unquote, canonized? I don't know. It seems like this kind of unconscious collusion can't be avoided. But as I study the blacks in the priesthood issue, I see the exact same patterns. It's a dance of one step forward, two steps back. But the lessons we can learn are, don't underestimate power and control, or the need for the powerful to save face. You have to know your players and think about timing and what could possibly go wrong when challenging authority. Because just like your dad saying, now you've gone too far, I'm doubling your time without the car. power will assert itself. Who knows? If we keep pushing on the bishop interview stuff, we could end up with a whole new page in the Doctrine and Covenants declaring bishop interviews about sexuality as doctrine. Elder Hugh B. Brown was 79 years old. They wore the man down and got him to sign the new document. It was later reported that Brown cried when he signed the official declaration. We know this because his grandson, Edward Firmage, later explained, "The grandfather managed to add language to Elder Lee's statement, endorsing full civil rights for all citizens, but he still resisted signing the statement. However, he suffered from advanced age and the late stages of Parkinson's disease, and he also had the flu at the time. With his grandfather in this condition, Elder Lee brought tremendous pressure to bear upon him, arguing that with President McKay incapacitated, grandfather was obligated to join the consensus with the Quorum of the Twelve. Grandfather, deeply ill, wept as he related the story to me just before he signed the statement that bore his and President Tanner's names. We also know from First Presidency minutes that this was the time when the shift came in using old explanations of the priesthood ban. In 1968, church leaders were told to stop answering questions about the race policy, with talk about the curse of Cain, etc. Not sure McConkie got the memo, though. Anyway, more on that later. They said, "The more we said about the subject, the more we shall have to explain. Any future statements on the race issue should be clear, positive, and brief." This doesn't mean, however, that they were abandoning these doctrines, only the attempts to explain them to the public. So here we go again. Lowry pressures them in the 40s, and we got the 1947 policy statement. Brown pressures in the 60s, and we get the 1969 policy. By now, the 69 statement represents the second time in LDS history when church leaders had affirmed black priesthood denial as officially sanctioned church doctrine. It was signed by Brown and Tanner, but not ailing President McKay. It was dated December 15, 1969. It was just 1 month before the death of David O. McKay on January 18, 1970. The declaration was distributed to media outlets throughout the United States, and it was read over the pulpit in Mormon chapels. It was also published in the Improvement Era and the Church News. There is nothing in the document linking the ban to a divine curse or premortal worthiness. Its strong points are that God is discriminatory. In this case, they mean he is pretty choosy to those whom he grants the priesthood. And also, they emphasize the church does support civil rights. There's nothing about the divine curse or anything linking blacks with pre-earth life, as we saw in the 1949 response to Lowry. Instead, they stated it was not clear why God had denied blacks the priesthood. These are reasons which we believe are known to God, but which he has not made fully known to man. Well, it's certainly shifted in the right direction, and you think that it would have been an easy revelation to receive for Spencer W. Kimball, especially given the fact that after Hugh B. Brown had signed the 1969 Declaration, it's reported that Spencer W. Kimball came up to him later crying and told him that Brown was right and we're wrong. Kimball lamented he did not have the courage to stand up to Lee. Well, courage in the end came to Kimball, but it was going to be a decade away. In a way, this 1969 document is a precursor to the essay released on race and the priesthood on .org in 2013. Shall we talk about Mormon doctrine? Might as well go ahead and do it right now. Mormon doctrine, not the theology, but the book. When I was a kid, Mormon doctrine was it. I can remember my mom practically running to our neighbor's house with the book clutched under her arm. She was going to use it to explain to our devout Lutheran neighbor why we believed in capital punishment, blood atonement, and all the rest. My mom was no different than most saints. Just glad to have one neat little place to look stuff up and get clarity on topics from literally A to Z. Aaron to Zoramites. Eileen the neighbor must have thought it was canonized doctrine. And really, didn't we all? The Mormon Church could probably be divided up into two groups today. Those who remember the importance of Mormon doctrine, the book, and those who don't. I'm going to guess the dividing line for that is about 1978. If you were born after 1978, McConkie Spunky. McConkie had the book published without approval, and the prophet and his friends were none too happy about it. McKay found hundreds of errors on almost every one of the almost 800 pages. And who was Bruce McConkie, anyway? The hierarchy was very miffed that the center of influence regarding doctrinal matters be moved away from the prophet to a book. The church has a history of liking to keep our doctrine a little muddled anyway. and some claim we really don't even have a set doctrine at all. So this move by McConkie was welcome to the members, but threatened the power of the top 15. Under pressure, Bruce R. allowed the book to go out of print. And that was the end of Mormon doctrine. Of course, I'm just kidding. If you think McConkie was going to go down that easily, you don't know McConkie. And 7 years later, he went back to 92-year-old McKay and convinced him to approve the republication, with the caveat, as he calls it, that he would remove and change certain controversial parts in a new, spiffed-up 1966 version. Well, phew, thank goodness. Now, at last, we can get all that weird folklore about blacks out. Oh, wait, this was 3 years before the 69 Declaration. So, no. All the entries dealing with blacks, classified under the headings on the Negro, caste system, Cain and Ham, remained as originally written. McConkie's views on the priesthood ban mirrored those of Joseph Fielding Smith, his father-in-law, and other church spokesmen. Neither President McKay or Apostles Peterson or Romney had any worries about these parts of the book concerning the priesthood ban, or stuff about black lineage or any of it. Well, good thing there was another edition in 1979. Modern times, people. I'm pretty sure the book took that stuff out by then. Au contraire, mon frère. The only change in the 1979 issue was they did go ahead and include the stuff about the all-worthy males' 1978 revelation. And that was pretty big of them. However, as much credit as McConkie's been given for disavowing previous beliefs, his entry on the Negro remained intact, affirming the curse, segregation, and racial inequality, and his continuing claims equating black worthiness with the less worthy pre-existent life were still in the book. Finally, in 2010, the book ever so quietly went out of print, marking the end of, I guess it was a controversial book, but no one knew it at the time. And no one knew it for years and years and years. It had encapsulated Mormon racial doctrine for decades, including this excerpt regarding the caste system. It says, "See bondage, preexistence, slavery, tribes of Israel." He said, "In a broad general sense, caste systems have their root and origin in the gospel itself. And when they operate according to the divine decree, the resultant restrictions and segregation are right and proper and have the approval of the Lord." To illustrate, Cain, Ham, and the whole Negro race have been cursed with a black skin, the mark of Cain, so they can be identified as a caste apart, a people with whom the other descendants of Adam should not intermarry. All this is not to say that any race, creed, or caste should be denied any inalienable rights. But it is to say that deity in his infinite wisdom, to carry out his inscrutable purposes, has a caste system of his own, a system of segregation of races and peoples. Well, it could go on and on, but you can look it up. So it looks like, at the end, the position of the church is that all these notions were incorrect anyway, and it means that Nelson Lowry's letters to the First Presidency actually contain God's truth. Everything Nelson wrote is absolutely accepted by the church today, but the prophet then specifically rejected the truth and held strong to false doctrine. Many people have been deeply troubled by the race and priesthood essay for this very reason, and we're going to be talking more about it in the future. Please send comments or questions or any ideas you may have for future podcasts to Wendy Merrill Perry on Facebook. Feel free to message me and I'll return your message. Or leave a comment at MormonDiscussions.org.